It's Wednesday, March 4th, 2009, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Good day, Stashers, and welcome to the podcast. Before we get things started, just a couple of notes on the legislative front. Illinois House Bill 2514, a medical marijuana measure, made it out of its committee on a 4-3 vote. And in Minnesota, Senate File 97, a medical marijuana measure, made it out of its committee on a 4-3 vote. A lot of those 4-3 votes going around, I suppose. All right, now those of you who are new to the Daily Audio Stash might not realize there's a blog to go along with this podcast at stash.normal.org, and on that blog we post many more stories than what we have time to cover here on the Daily Audio Stash. Think of it as the pulse of marijuana law reform throughout the country and around the world. Also included on the Stash blog is fun little stuff that helps to build community, and one of these things is the Stash Pot Quiz. Over the next 5 days, I'm going to be giving a few questions about marijuana and economics and how it relates to your state. Check the Stash blog at stash.normal.org at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern for the next 5 days for a new Stash Pot Quiz question. Also on the Stash blog, we have advertising. That's right, we've got banner ads and buttons in the sidebar where you can advertise your business, product, or service to a dedicated and growing audience of responsible adult cannabis consumers. You can place web-only ads, or you can get your advertising right here on the Stash podcast. All you gotta do is send an email to stash@normal.org with the subject line, Advertising Request, and we'll get right back to you. Also, if you're listening to the Stash and wondering how you can get involved in marijuana law reform in your area, go to normal.org and look for the local chapters in your area and join up. All it takes is your time and your dedication to help bring an end to adult marijuana prohibition. And if there's not a local chapter in your area, send me an email at stash@normal.org and we'll see what we can do about forming one in your area. We're going to spread the growing truth about cannabis from sea to shining sea and restore America's hemp heritage. But it starts with you. All right, now coming up on today's Stash, we've got our hemp headlines, including some great news from California on the Department of Motor Vehicles clarifying the driving rights of medical marijuana patients. And that will also be featured in our second interview segment as we listen in on a conference call with Americans for Safe Access and a few California medical marijuana patients who lost their driver's licenses, not for bad driving or tickets, but solely because they were medical marijuana patients. Also, today is our Cannabis Science Day, and we will be visiting with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, discussing the topic of the terms abuse, dependence, and addiction. What do they really mean scientifically, and how do they relate to marijuana use among adults? And it's Reggae Wednesday for our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com. Some great reggae from Marlon Asher with Ganja Farmer. Well, we had a vote here at Normal West Coast Media Headquarters whether we would do a bong or a pipe, and it came down to 4-3 in favor of just smoking whatever is nearby. So let's get to it. It's time for your Normal Daily Audio Stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. California DMV states medical marijuana alone not valid reason to suspend license. Oakland, California. The California Department of Motor Vehicles, or DMV, issued a new policy yesterday with regard to how it treats qualified medical marijuana patients. The DMV Driver Safety Procedure Manual was revised to include reference to medical marijuana, stating that, quote, use of medicinal marijuana approved by a physician should be handled in the same manner as any other prescription medication which may affect safe driving, end quote. The manual states that the existence of medical marijuana use, quote, does not in itself constitute grounds for a license withdrawal action, end quote. The change in DMV policy was the result of a lawsuit filed on November 19, 2008 by medical marijuana advocacy group Americans for Safe Access on behalf of Rose Johnson, a 53-year-old patient from Atwater, whose driving license was revoked because of her status as a patient. Despite Ms. Johnson's clean driving record, not having caused an accident in 37 years of driving, the DMV revoked her license on July 26, 2008. According to the DMV, Ms. Johnson's license was revoked, quote, because of an addiction to or habitual use of a drug, end quote, thereby rendering her unable to safely operate a motor vehicle, even though no evidence existed to substantiate this claim. In January, as a result of the lawsuit and a positive driving test by Ms. Johnson, the DMV reinstated her license and issued the new policy before the case had a chance to be heard in Superior Court. Advocates assert that the DMV policy of suspending and revoking the licenses of medical marijuana patients was widespread, occurring in at least 8 California counties, including Alameda, Butte, Contra Costa, Glen, Merced, Placer, Sacramento, and Sonoma. License revocations by the DMV, which have been based on a person's status as a medical marijuana patient, are often rationalized by calling the drivers, quote, drug abusers, end quote, despite no evidence of the claim. In California, this drug addict language was being used to deny medical marijuana patients the right to drive. Here in Oregon, drug addict language was used to revoke or deny medical marijuana patients their right to a concealed weapons permit. In most medical marijuana states, employers can deny a medical marijuana patient's right to work when a pre-employment urine test marks them as a drug addict. Across the country, women who are using marijuana medically to treat the nausea of morning sickness are considered drug addicts when their newborn's urine tests positive for THC metabolites and are denied the right to hold their own baby. Meanwhile, prescription drugs are advertised on television all day that say, until you know how Dametol affects you, don't drive or operate heavy machinery. No one thinks to take away the concealed handgun permit from the guy who gets an alcohol DUI. You can show up to your workplace drug testing center drunk and still pee clean enough for a job. Nobody takes the newborn baby away from the morbidly obese mother who has been passing on lousy nutrition to her baby in the womb. It's funny to me how much danger and risk we are willing to tolerate as a society from alcohol, prescription drugs, and obesity, but that little cannabis flower that makes you happy and never killed anyone, that's the one we scrutinize for safety. Cluster headaches responsive to smoking cannabis. So use Marinol. First, the good news. Something the migraine, cluster headache medical marijuana patient for whom I'm a caregiver could have told you without any scientific studies. Cluster attacks responsive to recreational cannabis and dronabinol. Pharmacological preparations of cannabinoid compounds have a variety of therapeutic uses in medicine, including different pain syndromes, but have not been previously reported as beneficial for cluster headache. We present a patient with cluster headache who was refractory to multiple acute and preventative medications, but successfully aborted his attacks with recreational marijuana use. Subsequent use of dronabinol provided equally effective pain relief. In other words, this guy got rid of his severe headaches by smoking pot or taking Marinol pills. But once you dig past that abstract and look into the full text of the paper, you step through Alice's looking glass into the world where 100% potent synthetic THC is a Schedule 3 prescribable drug, and 5% to 20% potent natural THC plus other medical cannabinoids is a Schedule 1 illegal drug. A 19-year-old right-handed university student presented to the Headache Center for evaluation and management of his cluster headaches. Over the past 2 years, he had a cyclical pattern of stereotyped attacks occurring predictably every 1 to 2 months, lasting approximately 2 weeks. During these 2-week cluster periods, he experienced one attack every other day. Each cluster period was typically followed by a remission phase lasting 1 to 2 months. However, over the past 3 months, the frequency gradually increased to 1 to 2 attacks daily. The majority of attacks would abruptly awaken him from sleep at 12:30 a.m. or 4:30 a.m. with excruciating right temporal and paraorbital pain. Each episode lasted 3 to 4 hours untreated, with the pain reaching maximal intensity within 10 minutes and declining within 10 minutes at its conclusion. He did not drink alcohol, but noted that marijuana use at the onset of his headaches consistently brought complete relief within 5 minutes of inhalation for each attack. Okay, so smoking pot relieved the headaches. That should be it, right? No. The researchers take him off the marijuana and subject him to traditional legal treatments for chronic headaches, including prednisone, methylprednisolone acetate, bupivacaine, verapamil, lithium, sodium valproate, melatonin, topiramate, nifedipine, indomethacin, zonisamide, venlafaxine, ergotamine tartrate, clonazepam, sumatriptan tablets, zolmitriptan nasal spray, ergotamine caffeine, oxycodone, aspirin butalbital caffeine, acetaminophen dichlorphenazone isomethaptine, and indomethacin. They're all tried, quote, without benefit, end quote, and with, quote, intolerable adverse effects, end quote. And I have a list of all those side effects and links to every one of those drugs I mentioned at the post at stash.normal.org, but I'll just give you a few of them, like nausea, vomiting, constipation, loss of appetite, extreme thirst, urinating more or less than usual, weakness, fever, feeling restless or confused, eye pain and vision problems, restless muscle movements in your eyes, tongue, jaw, or neck, pain, cold feeling, or discoloration in your fingers and toes, feeling lightheaded, fainting, slow heart rate, hallucinations, seizure, blackout or convulsions, depressed mood, thoughts of suicide or hurting yourself, chest tightness, fast or pounding heartbeats, and the worst adverse reaction, death. So, these researchers, as a last resort... Given the lack of responsiveness to multiple agents, dronabinol 5 mg was substituted for marijuana for acute treatment of his cluster headaches. Dronabinol consistently provided dramatic relief within 5 to 15 minutes of ingestion. Okay, so smoking pot or using Marinol helps and the pharmaceuticals don't. Now, I can understand giving the guy Marinol instead of marijuana if both are equally effective, if only just to keep him out of jail. What I can't understand is this conclusion by the researchers. It may be of future interest to ascertain if pain relief can be achieved when recreational marijuana or dronabinol are used in a cluster attack. We would not recommend routine use of recreational or pharmacological preparations of cannabis for treatment of cluster headaches because of the risk of long-term dependence and other potential adverse effects. You were more than willing to run this guy through 21 different pharmaceutical therapies, including steroids, oxycodone, and lithium, and you're worried about the dependence and adverse effects of cannabis. What kind of insanity is it where the herb that is safer and more effective than 21 dangerous, ineffective drugs is rejected by doctors who, as a last resort, turn to the synthetic preparation of one part of the exact same herb they're rejecting because it's too dangerous? Well, nobody ever said prohibition was logical. Will the Obama administration put justice back in the criminal justice system? With 1 in 31 Americans now under some form of correctional supervision, mass incarceration is hitting closer to home for urban, suburban, and rural residents who never envisioned family members would one day be locked away in remote prisons. Some have even been shipped off to other states. Out-of-state transfers are routine in the federal system and increasingly common in overcrowded state prison systems that contract with private prison operators. While California, New York, and Texas have begun to show slight decreases in their bloated prison populations, the South has become the epicenter of the latest incarceration upsurge. Kentucky, number one, Florida, number 5, Virginia, number 6, Alabama, number 7, and Louisiana, number 8, are in the nation's top 10 for imprisonment rate increases from 2000 to 2007. Drug-related arrests, nearly 2 million in 2007, continue to play a major role in driving up the number of jail and state prison inmates, while the majority of federal prisoners are doing time for drug offenses, more than 95,000 men and women in 2007. The sidebar article accompanying this piece, entitled A Report from the Front Lines on the War on Drugs, by lawyer Leonard C. Goodman, is compelling and calls on President Obama to commission a panel of experts to provide a report in the manner of the Schaefer Commission from 1972. Not every Democratic legislator is fearful of criminal justice reform, however. Freshman Virginia Senator Jim Webb is pushing for U.S. prison reform this spring. Now, when he heard that, the Washington Post quoted Robert D. Holsworth, a political science professor at Virginia Commonwealth University, saying of Webb's support for prison reform, quote, "He clearly has limited interest in the political art, you might say, of re-election," end quote. Well, look, I'm pretty impressed that a sitting official is more concerned with doing what is obviously right as opposed to making sure he gets re-elected. Senator Webb is different from many elected officials in that he is qualified to do things other than be a career politician.
There were 765,000 marijuana arrests in 2007. That's not for dealers and kingpins, no, that's just for simple possession. Multiply that by the average cost of each arrest, and what have you got? $7.6 billion spent on people just smoking some pot. That's enough money to buy health insurance for every child that needs it. That's enough cash to adopt every stray dog and enough left over to feed it. Mr. Obama, I kinda wrote this song for you. You got my vote for change. Now let's see what you can do.
Visit normal.org today. Who is telling you the truth about marijuana? The government? Scientists? Doctors? Which claims are scientifically valid, and which claims are reefer madness? Every Wednesday, we separate the stems of propaganda from the buds of truth with Normal's look at cannabis science. In a lot of my posts lately at the Daily Audio Stash, we've been talking about the idea of marijuana dependence. Nobody here claims that marijuana is absolutely harmless. In fact, some studies have shown that up to 9% of the people that use marijuana do develop some sort of clinical dependence. But what does that mean? And what does it mean when we talk about terms like dependence, abuse, and addiction? Well, the man to ask would be Dr. Mitch Earlywine, our regular correspondent here for Cannabis Science. And Dr. Mitch, welcome back.
Great to be on the show.
So first of all, let's go over that figure that I cited, the 9% dependence figure. What exactly does that mean?
Generally, dependence diagnoses focus on a set of seven symptoms and usually mean things like tolerance, withdrawal, and then some other problem that basically means you're screwing up in your life in some other domain, either socially or with your obligations at work or something along those lines.
Okay, so how would that differ from the term abuse? Is there an actual clinical definition of abuse that's different than dependence?
Exactly. So abuse is a separate diagnosis, and you only need one symptom, and it could be any of the following four: legal trouble, and that usually means recurrent legal trouble, but already you can see how this could be biased against folks who use a substance that's on the current side of the law. Failed obligations, where people are messing up at work or school or something like that. Using despite problems, so folks who use drugs even though they clearly have a problem. Alcoholics with liver disease who keep drinking, that kind of thing, they qualify for abuse. And then use in a physically hazardous way, so folks who are driving while intoxicated, or, you know, it's your job to run the forklift at work and you're taking too many Vicodin, that kind of thing.
Okay. And then finally, the addiction. Is there such a thing as marijuana addiction, and does that have a clinical definition?
And in fact, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the manual that's used to diagnose all the mental illnesses, has sidestepped this addiction idea, in part because it's taken on so many meanings in so many different locations. So a lot of folks, when they think of addiction, they usually think of dependence plus some kind of extra problems, or they, you know, are freewheeling it and have their own terms in a way that no longer has a scientific definition, but to them often means you're using it and I don't want you to.
So when we hear about these, these centers for treating marijuana addiction, would they be more accurate to say they're treating marijuana dependence?
At best. For some of these, when you start looking at their literature, it's folks who've been in trouble with the law. So, you know, they've got legal trouble and they might qualify for the abuse diagnosis. But a close look often shows that these aren't folks who are experiencing a whole lot of symptoms other than that. So they end up in these treatment programs simply because of legal problems. I'm not saying nobody has troubles with cannabis, and yeah, there, you know, are folks who report tolerance or they're using more than they want to or things like that. But there's no guarantee that any particular treatment center is going to address these formal diagnoses. The other thing is it's not like we've got separate treatments for abuse and dependence, so it doesn't even make sense in a sense of, oh, this is somehow going to give us important information on how do people battle their troubles. And so I've been turning away from these diagnoses and more into just, well, how is this turning into a hassle for you, and what can we do to make it so it's not a hassle any longer? The key behind both the abuse and the dependence diagnosis is there's got to be some kind of impairment or some kind of distress. So, you know, somebody comes to me and they say, I've got a single, you know, misdemeanor possession bust. Does that qualify me for abuse? And I have to say no. If you're, you know, in a decrim state and have a small amount, this isn't probably going to create an enormous amount of distress. And the idea that something like that would be diagnosable, in many ways just kind of reflects societal biases more than any kind of real syndrome that exists out in nature.
Mm. And you do make good mention of that, that legal problems that marijuana smokers would face just because of the fact that use is illegal. So, you know, you don't even have to get to the step of abuse to be in trouble with the law. You could just be using.
And in fact, you can see, you know, imagine somebody who smokes a ton of cigarettes or who, you know, somebody who could drink a fifth a day, but because it's part of a legal market, they wouldn't end up qualifying for an abuse diagnosis on that alone. And you can see in some ways this is kind of a slippery diagnosis and one that can run us into trouble. So people start saying, oh, substance abuse is on the rise. if it's marijuana abuse, I have to note that, you know, arrests are also on the rise. So is it really that there are more problems, or is it just this legal trouble symptom suddenly rearing its head because more arrests are happening, not because of some wild characteristic of cannabis?
You know, when I think about these our opponents and their demonization of marijuana, a lot of times what I think is that they're not stupid, and they can look at the numbers, and they know that there's millions and millions of people that use marijuana recreationally, and only 800,000 or so that ever get arrested for it. And maybe their perspective is this idea that if you get busted at all with marijuana, then you must be having some sort of problem with it, because most of the people that use it don't ever get caught. What do you think about that idea?
It's funny, because it reflects this sort of tacit assumption that, you know, if you've been caught once, odds are high you've done it a whole lot of times and done it in this really maladaptive way. And so that's why I try to emphasize in the diagnosis that it's got to be recurrent legal problems. So, you know, if you're busted for a giant grow, you might not even be a smoker for all we know.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that, you know, shouldn't really qualify as substance abuse. And then suppose you have multiple possession busts because you're running, you know, a dispensary, or you're trying to, you know, do something to help medical users or something along those lines. Again, I feel like that doesn't reflect a problem related to consumption. It's really reflecting a problem with either prohibition or a misunderstanding about how laws are enforced in your area, and so then you end up with you know, troubles with the police that really don't have anything to do with any psychoactive issues with cannabis.
Now, to look at it from the other side, we again want to emphasize that there are some people that have problems with cannabis, and it can be related to the person or just the circumstances or whatever. So to avoid people using the idea that cannabis is illegal and that's a cop out for having responsibility over it, how do we determine, or how does a person self-evaluate to understand that they are having a problem with cannabis, and what should they do about it?
As corny as this sounds, I feel like one of the key indicators is it still fun for you? So is this a special event, something you enjoy, and something that you actually get to get a kick out of? Or does it feel like, oh, I've got to do this because otherwise I won't feel normal, or I've got to do this just because that's what I do on Friday nights, or something like that? Now, with, you know, my friends who are medical users, they absolutely do have to use it in order to feel normal, and I feel like that's a completely separate issue. But when I have folks who say, you know, I get up first thing in the morning and I tend to get high, it's just what I've always done, I don't even know if it's any fun for me anymore, well, then by all means, can you put it off later in the day? Can you go days in a row without it? And you actually find out you like it more in this kind of curious way, where it becomes a special event again, you get to enjoy it again, and all of that's there. And then the other thing to focus on is just, are there negative consequences for real? And I think most folks can be candid with themselves. Is this something that is coming between me and my family, or, you know, me and my pals? Could I be doing better at work if I were getting high less often? That sort of thing. But often, you know, you take a cold hard look, and it's more about the timing of your use than anything else. And people discover that they can still use without any negative consequences if they pay attention to how often, how much, and what time.
So it does sound quite variable, that perhaps one person might be a daily user who functions quite well, and another person who uses once a month, maybe that's a problem for them?
It's curious, because it says a lot about the setting. If you're only using once a month, but you do it in a way that makes things negative for you at work, for example. So you only get high once a month, but it's right before you have to take a big exam, right before you have to do some important interview. That could be really maladaptive and something that could be easily fixed. Other folks who, you know, say, well, I get high every night for about 90 minutes before I fall asleep, I'm hard-pressed to say what the big negative consequences of that are, given, you know, that it really shouldn't necessarily interfere with any obligations. It couldn't be physically hazardous. Is it really going to be some sign of future troubles? I just don't think so.
You know, I'm the son of a former drug addict and alcoholic who went back to school and became a drug and alcohol counselor. And this subject of dependence, abuse, and addiction is something that I could probably chat with you for hours, but we do have limited time. Let's give our listeners a chance, if they do have more questions on this subject, to give them your email address if they want to ask more in depth.
Sure. I'm at 420 Research. That's the numbers 420 Research, R-E-S-E-A-R-C-H, at gmail.com. And I love talking about this, and I actually have a whole chapter devoted to it in understanding marijuana, if folks want to check that out.
Excellent. Dr. Earlywine, thanks again for joining us here for Cannabis Science.
Talk to you again soon.
It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our daily audio stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. The battle to end adult marijuana prohibition can sometimes seem endlessly frustrating and impossible to overcome. One way we bond as a community and draw strength to continue is by rejuvenating our spirit through art and music. The Marijuana Music Awards exist to recognize those sonic artists in all genres of music who feature a ganja-friendly message to motivate and inspire all the cannabis community. Our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com, feature the finest in blues, rock, jazz, hip-hop, rap, reggae, country, bluegrass, and dance music to enhance that 420 feeling and refresh all you stashers for another day on the front lines of the drug war. Enjoy this cut from MarijuanaMusicAwards.com and visit our blog at stash.normal.org to learn how you can vote for your favorites and enter your Toker Tunes in the 2009 Marijuana Music Awards. Reggae Wednesday from Marijuana Music Awards brings us the internationally recognized anthem, Ganja Farmer, by Marlon Asher from Trinidad. Marlon is a conscious reggae music artist. With his songs, Marlon says he communicates to the world the spiritual soulfulness of reggae music. Marlon has toured the Caribbean, USA, Africa, Europe, and the UK. He has shared the stage with veteran artists such as Damian Marley, Collie Buds, and Sizzla, to name a few. Marlon recently released his new CD, Unconditional Love, which includes today's song and the similarly themed track, Marijuana. Marlon Asher's music is both forceful and melodic, with lyrics of belief and faith. The dominant message of Marlon's new album is one of love, peace, and optimism. The music is fresh, while firmly linked to the roots tradition. Marlon's latest CD features production styles from New York, Africa, Jamaica, and Trinidad, giving a taste of his global journey. If you like the positive vibes and great reggae music, check out Marlon Asher at marlonasher.com and myspace.com/ganjafarmer. Enjoy today's song, Ganja Farmer, by Marlon Asher, which now has almost 3 million hits on YouTube. And registered stashers will get your own MP3 download of this song. It's Marlon Asher with Ganja Farmer.
I'm a ganja planter, call me the ganja farmer. Deep down in the earth, we may put the ganja. Babylon, come light it at the fire, me a chant. Yes, I'm a ganja planter, call me the ganja farmer. Deep down in the earth, we may put the ganja. Babylon, come. Big stinking helicopter flow through the air. With them calling, them call it weed eater. Them never did it when me was out in water, or when me did them blind fertilizer. Yet out of the sky them spitting fire. And I'm a little youth man with a hot temper. Me dig up me stinking rocket launcher, and in all the air this buzz the helicopter me a chant. I'm a ganja planter, call me the ganja farmer. Deep down in the earth we me put the ganja. Babylon come a lot in a tar fire me a chant. Yes, I'm a ganja planter, call me the ganja farmer. Deep down in the earth we me put the ganja. Babylon come, yeah, true no man. True Jaja bless I with no for good vibes, man. And true me of the hardest set a ganja in a the land. Make doctors get no meditation, and so them coulda give it to them sick patient. Make chemists get no meditation, and so them coulda brew new medication. Make singers get some inspiration, and so them coulda spread your message pon the land. Me a chant, yes I'm a ganja planter, call me the ganja farmer. Deep down in the earth we may put the ganja. Babylon come a light it at a fire me a chant. Yes I'm a ganja planter, call me the ganja farmer. Deep down in the earth we may put the ganja. Babylon come, watch out. Come and say ganja, 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 ganja. If you don't want to call it, then call it sensaminia. If you don't want to call it, then call it marijuana. If you don't want to call it, then call it the indica. And from me bonnet in a chalice and rush it a paper. Lord, see me love me ganja. Some ganja planter. Call me the ganja farmer. Deep down in the earth, let me put the ganja. Babylon, come on, light it at a fire, me a chanan. Yes, I'm a ganja planter. Call me the ganja farmer. Deep down in the earth, let me put the ganja. Babylon, come. Well, it's like 10,000 Babylon in one blue van. Welcome, Chester and the small it, yam ganja land. 10,000 Babylon in one blue van. Welcome, Chester and the small it, yam ganja land. Ganja planter, call me the farmer. Deep down in the earth, with me moon the ganja. Full of me ganja, ganja, me ganja. Low the ganja, ganja, ganja. Ooh, me ganja, ganja.
Of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana, and over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and co-workers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
The medical marijuana advocacy group Americans for Safe Access filed suit against California's Department of Motor Vehicles to reinstate the license of one Rose Johnson, whose license had been suspended solely because she admitted to being a medical marijuana patient. ASA held a press conference today by teleconference, and Ms. Johnson spoke about her experience, as well as other medical marijuana patients whose driving rights had been discriminated against by DMV just because of their medical use of marijuana.
So without further ado, I want to get to the first guest, which is who is Matt Vaughn. And as I said earlier, he's from El Dorado County. And He'll tell you about his story, and then we'll move to Rose and then to Joe. So take it away, Matt.
Hi there. I'm Matt Vaughn. I've been a patient for a long time, a glaucoma patient. I'm otherwise healthy, and I was driving north on Interstate 5 in a rather remote area very early on a Sunday morning on a clear, dry June day, and was stopped for speeding, the only car on the highway there. And when I was pulled over, I did not have my driver's license on me, and even though I had the number, the officer looked it up. He said he smelled marijuana, asked me if I had any in the car. I said I did. He said because I didn't have my driver's license, I couldn't refuse searching the car. So he was more or less required to search the car. And he, after going through it and checking everything, including my drink, to see if there's alcohol in it, I assumed, and a field sobriety test, he took the quantity that I had, which was an ounce and a little more, about 36 grams of marijuana, and my pipe. And at that time, I told him I was a patient, qualified patient, state of California. He said he didn't recognize any of that. They go by federal law in Glynn County. And so I was rather frustrated, partly because it meant turning around, turning my 3 hours of back driving and then another 3 hours just to get back to that point to refill what he had taken from me. Anyway, I told him I would get it back. It would be you, me, and a judge, and state law is the state law. And I ended up getting it back. But in the meantime, my license was questioned on the health. I guess they sent me a physical form to question my ability to drive, and I had to go to first my doctor and get an exam, and then my ophthalmologist and get an exam, and eventually I had a I guess an administrative review hearing on my license, in which they indicated that they didn't understand how anybody could operate a motor vehicle safely when they smoked marijuana in any situation at all, and didn't matter whether it was when you were driving or not. They if you were a patient, then you were incapable of driving, and they just, that assumption carried through to the second administrative hearing, and it was rather frustrating to try to get them to understand. I didn't see it any different than any other prescription drug, in which you are able to determine whether you can safely drive or not. I'm a retired mechanic. I've driven professionally for Honda for 20 years and as a dealership, and never had any problem or accidents. And anyway, I couldn't explain that to them. It got frustrating. My license had been suspended. I had no other way to go other than the writ of mandamus with taking DMV into Superior Court, and I couldn't do that myself. I called ASA. They helped Mr. Elford put the writ together for me and got it filed. It took months of hanging out and waiting, and eventually the day before the hearing, the first meeting, I think it was, my license appeared in the mail, and the conditions of the suspension was set aside, meaning they were found to be untrue, and so rather than having my license given back and it's on my record, it was basically unsuspended. It was the condition was set aside. We didn't get the policy change that we wanted to get. They just handed me back my license, and we wanted to try to press this to not happen to other people also. I'm an activist at this, and I was rather concerned that this was happening to other people also and not just for my own license. anyway, turned out okay for me personally, but again, we didn't get that last step there. ASA did the best they could, and it helped out enormously. I'm glad to see that they finally have done something. It's rather frustrating as a patient to try to explain these things to this faceless DMV. So you do all this over the phone also when you do your hearings, so you don't really come face-to-face with anybody. Or at least I never did. So anyway, that's
thanks,
where
Matt.
Yeah.
Thanks, I appreciate it. So as Matt said, back in 2006 when they reinstated or set aside his suspension, we did not achieve a policy change at that time and would have been satisfied if we had not seen any further violations by the DMV. Unfortunately, violations continued to occur and over the next couple of years, and that's why we followed through with filing a lawsuit on behalf of Rose Johnson, more vigorously demanding a policy change. And so for that reason, I don't think the DMV can get away with saying that that the current policy that they just issued on Monday has always been the policy of the DMV. Clearly, it has not been the case based on evidence from our experience. So with that, I'll pass it on to Rose Johnson, who can tell you her story.
Hi, I'm Rose, and thank you for having me today. I don't know where to start. I'm a marijuana smoker. I was in a car accident in 1990 and injured my back and neck. And this last year when I went to get my driver's license, I passed the written test and they sent me my license in the mail. And 2 weeks later, they revoked it and gave me a hearing date included with this revoking. And so I had to go down to Fresno for a hearing, and one of the questions they asked me were my medication. So I had to include it because it is medical marijuana, and that's what I use it for. And so just by my testimony alone, they were going to keep my license from me. And then I got in touch with Americans for Safe Access, and they helped me so much in helping me through this case and getting the right things in order that I didn't know how to do to protect the other people from not having to go through this. And I had to go through two different hearings, and they requested at the end for me to take a driving test. So I complied with them and took the driving test and passed it, and they now have my license given back to me, and it's still in the mail waiting to receive for me to have it now back to where I can have my freedom. And I guess that's my story.
Hi, I'm Joe Elso, Chief Counsel for Americans for Safe Access. And as you've heard from the stories of Matt Vaughn and Rose Johnson, this is a real problem. And the courts recognize how important of a right it is to be able to maintain your driver's license if you're a safe driver. Both Matt and Rose have stellar driving records, which is partially why we thought their cases would be precedent-setting cases. What happened was we achieved what we initially set out to achieve in Matt Vaughn's case, which is getting him his license back. And so at that point, we couldn't it wasn't the most effective case to pursue a policy change, although that was what we were seeking in that case. But then we saw a spike in complaints between 6 months and a year ago. We saw a spike in complaints about people having their licenses revoked, and Rose Johnson then contacted us, and we thought her case would be a very good test case in this area, and so we took her case. And we wanted to achieve two things when we took her case. First, we wanted to get Ms. Johnson her license back as soon as possible, and second, we wanted to get a formal written policy implemented by the DMV regarding medical marijuana, so this didn't continue to happen to other medical marijuana patients, and we've now achieved both of those goals. I know the DMV's position is that this is a policy that they've had for some time, and they're simply, I guess, kind of codifying the written policy. There are various ways that we can kind of poke holes in that argument. One of which is that when Ms. Johnson first approached us, I wrote a letter to the DMV stating that this was a problem, stating that her license was revoked solely because she was a patient, and that's clear in the record, and requesting that they have a policy so this doesn't occur in the future. They could have simply said, we already have that policy, we'll try to fix it in this case, or even just told me that they already have that policy. Instead, they simply ignored the letter. The letter was sent in August. I got no response. So that's what then prompted us to file suit in late November. Again, no response for over a month when we're contacted. And at that point, you know, they ask, what can we do to settle this case? And the answer was, you give Ms. Johnson her license back and you effectuate a formal written policy on medical marijuana, which is what they've done. And so we've accomplished the purposes of the case. We're very pleased with the new DMV policy, and we hope that what happened to Ms. Johnson and Mr. Vaughn doesn't happen to any other medical marijuana patient in the future.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, The Growing Truth About Cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with reminders from our activist agenda at stash.normal.org/agenda. In Salem, Oregon, the Oregon American Civil Liberties Union is sponsoring a lobbying day for civil rights in Oregon. Medical marijuana patients are expected to attend and stand up for their rights. There's going to be a hearing next Tuesday in New Hampshire on House Bill 648. This is the bill to make New Hampshire the 14th medical marijuana state. And next Friday on ABC TV, there's going to be a John Stossel special, Bull in America, talking about the crackdown of medical marijuana as part of the program. Check your local listings. It will be on ABC Friday, March 13th. Also, if you haven't taken the time to do it yet, join Normal and help pay for this podcast. Thanks for supporting us and making The Stash the growing truth about cannabis on the internet. We'll talk to you tomorrow, and until next time, take care of each other, tokers.